from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, Berkeley-based wine merchant Kermit Lynch has been selling and distributing his favorite Italian and French wines for over 40 years. He's known for favoring wines that express their terroir, a French term that refers to the natural environment in which a wine is produced, including factors like soil, geography, and climate. He'll join us to discuss his career and his influential book, Adventures on the Wine Route, A Wine Buyer's Tour of France, which is being re-released this month in a 25th anniversary edition. That's up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Berkeley-based California wine merchant and pioneer wine importer Kermit Lynch joins us in studio for this hour. He's a wine writer and owner of a French vineyard. He's also the author of Adventures on the Wine Route, just recently released in its 25th anniversary edition. And he's also the author of Inspiring Thirst. And we welcome him to this morning's second Forum hour. Good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I thought maybe we'd begin by talking about some things that have stirred up controversy with you, and that is California wines and all the talk about new oak and high alcohol and pop wines and only ripe fruit harvest and depressed acids and those sort of things. I mean, you've taken a lot of shots at California wines. Where are you now? Have they finally come around?
I wish I knew. I've concentrated for so long on French and Italian wines, I'm not really aware of what's happening in California today. When I opened my shop, it was a different story. I carried a lot of California wines, and that's how I started. I went out and to the wineries in California to buy direct, to go out and taste, see what I wanted to sell in my store. And then that's what I do today. It's just that I do it in France and Italy.
You go across the pond, as they say. but you've certainly talked a good deal about, actually, I'll go right to your book, Robert Olney, your mentor.
Richard.
Richard Olney, excuse me, writes the introduction about the FWDP, the fine wine drinking public.
Right.
And there's some sense of maybe even some disdain in all these wine tastings and all the kind of varieties of wine that go into wine tastings. And
I'm all for wine tastings if you're just going to do it to have fun with some friends. That's a great way to enjoy yourself and argue about the wines. But that as a democratic vote on which is the finest wine, I don't think it works. A wine tasting has to be structured. You have to start with the lightest wine and go to the heaviest wine. If not, if you start with if your first glass is the most alcoholic wine, the most tannic wine, physically, your palate, it won't register the lighter wine. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It sort of obliterates the wines that follow.
And yet these tastings, especially in the California wine tastings, have so many varieties, and you're doing looking for that 100-point. In fact, let's talk about that. I mean, because you've also expressed some real concern about that system of scoring wines and grading them on the 100-point system.
Well, I have because I think it's it just doesn't work. It's not realistic at all. I import Muscadet. It's a little white from the Loire Valley that is hard to beat with raw oysters. That's its raison d'être. And you look at the critics, and every time they judge Muscadets, like 88 out of 100, 89 out of 100, where a big fat Chardonnay with a lot of oak or a big fat white Burgundy is going to get 100 points if the taster's really impressed with it. That's just the way it is. In other words, the Muscadet is penalized for being itself, for realizing that which it is supposed to be. It's underrated, I would say.
Well, and in fact, what do you like now? I was reading something, we were talking about Croatian wines. You mentioned France and Italy, but...
No, I don't
know. You haven't? Croatian wines are coming up something in vogue?
I've heard that, but I've never tasted one.
So you just stick with the French and the Italian.
Each wine culture is so interesting, and there's so much depth to them. I think Yeah, it fulfills, those two fulfill me.
I know. Well, when I read your book, what I was struck by was just how much you spend time in the wine cellars and mm-hmm. how you learn that whole culture and that whole
That's right.
art, really, from the cellars themselves.
That's right, and that continues today.
Mm-hmm. And you're splitting your time between France and Berkeley?
I've been doing that since 1988, right? About 6 months, 6 months.
And let's talk just for a moment, if we can, about something you said about wine being magical and wine being all pleasure, which sounds mm-hmm. maybe a little hedonistic. You know, there are people who get wine snobs and, you know, too much concern about wine and too much emphasis. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, we've got a wine shortage now, a global wine shortage, which is going to shock some people. But looking actually at a story out of CNN, the industry is experiencing an undersupply of nearly 300 million cases. You'll be glad to hear this, maybe. According to a report from Morgan Stanley, there's not enough wine in the world, and the problem's going to get worse.
Can I give out my phone number and address?
Well, all the information you'd like here, but you can plug away here. But
we've got a few cases over there in Berkeley.
A few cases, that's right. Do you brew? How much of your own do you brew? Any? Do you do any brewing?
Brewing and you mean
vinifying? Do you do any
winemaking?
Yeah, vinifying. I'm going to get the right lexicon here, yeah.
I've never made a wine.
I've never in your life?
I've never been inclined to it. It doesn't appeal to me. I like to step in after the grapes have been picked, and then from my travels, from my experience, then I have some things to say. But to actually grow the grapes and all that, I at my winery, I have people who do that. It's a 50% partnership, and I went into it because I didn't buy it because I wanted to make wine, but I wanted to have something to say about what happens after the grape juice has fermented. What do we do with it after that?
There are a lot of rich people now going into the wine or mm-hmm. opening vineyards, aren't
mm-hmm.
there?
Well, that's been going on forever. Look at Rothschilds and Mouton and Lafite.
Yeah, it's almost become a hobby
back.
For like buying a team or something.
Romanée Conti goes back to the Prince de Conti.
Talking to Kermit Lynch. By the way, the 25th anniversary edition of Adventures on the Wine Route comes out on November 12th and is available at Kermit Lynch's shop in Berkeley and on Amazon.com. And on the 15th of November at 6:30, he'll be at San Francisco's Wine Trading Company for a book signing and tasting, and we'll give you more of his activities as the hour progresses. But what about all this emphasis on terroir? New York Times says wine is coming around to you on that. And what is it, really? I mean, soil, environment, habitat, all those things, yeah.
It's a lot of things, and you can't even get the French to agree on it. I'm convinced that vinification is part of terroir. In other words, when I arrived in France, you go from village to village. They might both be making Syrah, but there would be differences in the way it was made in one village. And then as you move down towards the south, that things would change, and they had another slight variations on how they would vinify it. And these traditions, to me, I think those are important in preserving terroir. It's not just the soil they grow in. It's everything around it, and including the vinification.
So how did you come to wine? You're the son of a preacher man, I believe, as the song would have it. In fact, you're also someone who has made some music of your own in collaboration with Boss Skaggs. Let's get some of those Bonafides out there. But how'd you come to wine?
Music and wine sort of came together to me. I was raised in San Luis Obispo, and in those days there were no vineyards there to speak of. But a married couple, just graduated from Berkeley, moved in next door to me and my parents. And they started inviting me over, and we'd talk, and they started playing music. Their thing was classical music, which I had no experience with that at all. And they always drank wine with lunch and dinner, and I took part in it. After that, I was stuck on both of them. When I moved to Berkeley, I was a classical music teacher. I would collect records, and my wife came home one day with a Jimmy Reed double album, Jimmy Reed at Carnegie Hall. Unforgettable. Changed my life.
That did it, huh?
That one did it.
Well, you know, you once said we got to get away from size with wine. We got to get to aroma and flavor. When you're talking about size, it's like talking about how long a book is or how loud the music is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. To me, it's the same thing. And if you've got one piece played louder, and to talk about music, if one piece is louder, you don't hear the other piece. And wine is the same way. It can be obliterated by a more powerful wine. And I think that's where we get into trouble with these tastings and everything. Apples and oranges, the old argument.
The palate becomes inured or something along those lines. But you say
alcohol is a deadener, right?
Also, yeah, exactly right. Yeah. But you also said that wine goes with music. It also goes with food. And I think you've made the case, been a strong advocate for thinking about wines in terms of the food they go with, as opposed to I'm just going to drink this wine because it gets 93 points or because it's so expensive.
It's completely divorced from the table, all this point system, just like the Muscadet. Serve me the Muscadet with good fresh oysters, that's 100 points. A good Muscadet, good fresh oysters. And you can't divorce the two. Muscadet isn't made to be drunk alone and compared to other wines. It's made for certain foods.
You talked about hearing that album by Jimmy Reed and what an event it was in you. I think the main event to some extent in forming your vinology or, you know, who you are as a wine figure had to do with that Burgundy winemaker, Hubert
de Monti.
Hubert de Monti, yeah.
Right.
What was it about his winemaking that had such an impression or impact on you?
Well, it's something that has come to mean a lot to people in this so-called natural wine movement today. There was a certain purity to it. Mm-hmm. That's the only word I can think of. Wines in those days in France were, most of the wines available were from shippers or négociants who were blenders. Getting down into the cellar with de Monti, I discovered wine from his little piece of earth, and right next to that little piece of earth, he had another plot of vines with a different name. You know, so just moving 10 yards away, that piece of land had a little different exposition, and he explained to me. And the wind comes through here in the mornings, and the cold wind hits this vineyard, but it doesn't hit the next one, and that's one of the reasons you get these variations. And It was a revelation to me to see what wine was capable of expressing.
Talking again with Kermit Lynch, who is the author of, and it's coming out in a new edition, 25th Anniversary Adventures on the Wine Route. And I told him before we went on the air that this is a book that has received praise from MFK Fisher, and that's about as good as it gets. I studied creative writing at San Francisco State many years ago.
That's right.
What about your palate? I mean, people talk about Kermit Lynch's palate as if it's maybe something we were just talking about, out of this world stuff in the last segment, astronomical stuff, as if you've got some very distinctive and in some ways uncharacteristic, maybe even anomalous type of palate.
Well, first, I think everybody's palate is different. All the experts I know, none of them have the same palate. For example, I'm not real quick on seeing that a wine is corked. It's not the first thing I notice. One of my employees, Michael Butler, the least little tinge, and he's on top of it. And he'll say, "Oh, this has got a little cork taste." And I say, "Well, no, I don't get it." And I say, "Okay, we'll get another bottle." And he gets another bottle, and we taste again. And I see, damn right, it has this little cork tinge. And for me, I'm very, very, it's sulfur dioxide that really, just a little bit too much, and it's hard for me to enjoy the wine. And there are other good tasters who the amount of sulfur in the wine just doesn't strike them. So every palate's different.
Well, let's talk about yours, though, for the moment. I mean, what wines would you be personally, to a profound extent, impoverished by if they did not exist?
See, rosé, red, and white.
That kind of covers it. Well, let's get a little more specific, though. I mean, some of the real, maybe even more exotic imports, if you will.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to answer because I would say what appeals to me is diversity. That's very important to me. And when I talk about pop wines and these kind of oaky monsters, that's what I don't like. These, in a way, sometimes I think when you order a California wine.
And, excuse me, oaky monsters, you have nothing to do with Steinbeck or Oklahoma. I'm talking about wine that is made in the oak, just so people don't
exactly,
get
exactly.
Amazed how people can confuse things.
Yeah. My preacher dad was from Oklahoma, so that's a different kind of oaky. Yes.
But please finish what you were saying.
Yeah. Well, I was struck. Somebody came into the shop one day and said, "Oh, when I taste a wine, I always know when it's your wine." And that I couldn't understand at all, because when I look at my stock, it's full of diversity. The wines
not
are
homogenized.
So different.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I had to wonder, well, what does he mean? There must be a little something to them, but I'll tell you, I don't know what it is.
Well, but yet you have a distinctive kind of reputation. What do you suppose that's based on? Or what do people tell you it's based on? Your palate? Or the kind of wines you import and bring in? Or the writing you've done?
Michael, I'm stumped. I don't know how to answer that.
So I don't mean to ask you questions that are going to stump you here. But I would at least wager, or I would at least provide a kind of tentative answer, that a lot of it has to do with trusting you and trusting your taste and your expertise.
Well, I would hope so. That's 40 years now I've been doing this, and I've made it clear what I'm trying to do in my books and in the monthly brochures that I write. And I think right now, when I look at the world of imported wines, there are a lot of people doing now what I started doing. In fact, sometimes I think I wrote the book. You know, I've taught everybody how to go out and do what I do. Not a very smart business move, but this has blossomed to such an extent that it surprises me. And after that New York Times interview, when the fellow at the beginning of the interview says something about here. The sorts of wines I champion are now really, you know, ascending in the market.
It's true.
That struck me as I felt a little.
You should feel damn good about it.
Victory
dance. Yeah, no, you should feel really good about it. You've made your impact on the world of wine and continue to make your impact. And of course, you've had a long and enduring friendship with Alice Waters. And does she see wine the way you do? Are you on the same page with her? Pretty much.
I'm a lot more concentrated on wine than she is.
I mean, in terms of the connection to food.
When you look at the connection, there's definitely, what she did in seeking out, when you think how she changed food, really?
You know what?
It's amazing, you know, that all the small farmers that we have today, that didn't exist before Alice.
Not only that, but I think it was Tom Luddy on this program, and then Bud Trillin said the same thing to me. All those revolutionaries in Berkeley in that period, the only real revolution came from Alice Waters. I don't mean to be comical about it, but it's true. Getting people to realize that certain wines go with certain foods is something that I associate certainly a lot of what Alice has been about, and you too.
I would say with Alice, what influenced me, I can remember one thing. I walked in one day into the kitchen, and she was there going through boxes of lettuce. This was really in the early days. And there was a big garbage can right next to the counter, and she went through the lettuces. I'd say 9 out of 10 of them went into the garbage can. And she was looking for that. And I remembered that when I would go looking for wine. You know, I wouldn't feel a success or a failure if I went to a winery and I didn't like the wine and I didn't decide to import it. To me, that was just as natural as Alice, you know, sifting through the lettuce.
She gave you a lesson on being selective, then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a serious lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we're going to be selective and invite you to call us. I mean, in the sense of if you have something that you want to ask about wine or tell us about wine, particularly about fine wines or... I want to talk about fine wines a little bit with Kermit, too, or just have questions for him. You know, one of our leading wine sellers and wine merchants and wine writers in the world, And you can feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls. That's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments, or you can join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I was just going to tell you an anecdote quickly about going to a wine tasting once where they had all these bottles wrapped in aluminum, mm-hmm. some very fine, expensive wines. They had some medium wines, and they had two-buck chuck. And there were a lot of people there who thought, two-buck chuck is one of the better-tasting wines. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that may sound like a horror story to you, but maybe not.
No, I think it's been proven statistically that most people shouldn't spend a lot of money on wine. We know that.
Well, let's talk about that, because these high-priced wines, you've been very critical and skeptical about them. Why?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in the interview in the New York Times, I made a point about that, is a $10, is a $50 wine better than a $10 wine? There's no way to know. And once you admit what I just said about everybody's got their own palate, there's no reason for you to think that a $50 bottle is going to be better than a $10 bottle. It's the winery that's decided what to charge. It's not a point, it's not a scoring system. And I think a lot of people think, oh, if it's $100 a bottle, it's better than $40.
I think most people probably think that.
And I see, yeah. I don't think that's true at all.
So how does the person decide if not by price? I mean, what would you give them as far as equipping them with?
Well, I'm sorry, but you have to start tasting some wine, making up your
you
own mind.
You have to apologize for that.
It's rough, but it can be done
at
home.
Yeah, it's hard work, but some people have to do it. I understand. Can you talk a little bit about Gaston, the guy that you write about here?
Sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
sure.
Just a fascinating character, wasn't he?
Quite an introduction to French wine. But I just imagine that he was, had a horrible, dominating father, and was just drinking himself silly every day to try to cope with that situation at home. Is that what you mean about Gaston?
Yeah. I mean, that's what comes across in your writing. Again, the writing is stylized and engaging writing. And again, congratulations on your 25th anniversary. On November 24th at 2 p.m., by the way, Kermit Lynch will be appearing in conversation with Raj Parr at the Chapel at an event sponsored by Books, Inc. You can visit booksinc.net for more information. And you can join us. Again, you can do that by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Or if you have questions or comments, you can call us. Our toll-free number available, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And I wasn't kidding about this global wine shortage. It's really global products. So if people think I was, maybe inventing this out of whole cloth, but it's, as I said, it's a story out of CNN. Production in Europe dropped 10% in 2012. This is a report from mm-hmm. Morgan Stanley. And global production fell by more than 5% last year, to the lowest level since the 60s, primarily due to bad weather in France and in Argentina.
And this year, too, 2013, same story.
When we come back, we'll hear from you. Kermit Lynch is our guest. Adventures on the Wine Route comes out again in its 25th anniversary edition on November 12th, a classic. And we'll talk more with him, hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. I thought we'd be inundated with calls from Napa and Sonoma, getting it from all over the Bay Area, of course. Kermit Lynch is our guest this hour. He's the owner of Kermit Lynch Wine in Berkeley, Kermit Lynch Wine Merchant in Berkeley, and author of Adventures on the Wine Route, a wine buyer's tour of France, which is being reissued this month. And he's been selling and distributing his favorite Italian and French wines for over 40 years and is known to favor wines that express their terroir, which is a French term that refers to the natural environment in which a wine is produced. Like we said, soil, geography, climate, all that. We're talking about his career and his influential book, Adventures on the Wine Route. Let's go to our calls, and we begin with Armand, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. This is Armand.
Armand, I'm sorry.
No problem. First of all, I wanted to thank you for doing such a fabulous job with all these programs, especially this one, which is very dear to my heart. I'm actually calling from Palo Alto, but really am a resident of Geyserville in California, so you're getting some call from Sonoma, so you should be comforted by that.
Okay. Thank you for the comfort.
Thank you. Just wanted to also let you know that I'm the owner of a winery called Starlight Vineyards, and much to what the speaker is talking about, we came out to make wines that were European in style and didn't have the same concepts of the heavy American oak. Mary Edwards and I launched this project together, and the joke about our Zinfandel was to create a Chateau Margaux out of Zinfandel grapes, so I totally understand the stylistics that you're talking about. But what I wanted to specifically talk about is a vinification whether vinification is part of the terroir or not. So we ventured in 2007 to make a Viognier, and it was interesting. Many years later, I found that that same vineyard that we had bought some fruit from in the Carneros was split in two parts. Half of it we took, and half of it the winery Dariush took. And so I went out and tasted the wines that Dariush had made out of that same vineyard that was previously owned by Voss. And I can tell you the two Viogniers could not have been more different. So about the concept of the vinification being part of the terroir, what we tried to make was a...
For the lay audience say what that is? That's converting the juice of the grapes, for example, into the wine by fermentation, by the process of fermentation. Vinification,
correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Or the process of making the wine as a broader topic. So what we tried to make on our Viognier was a Viognier that would be akin to the Condrieu style, which would be lighter in body, really quite fragrant, using neutral oak as the primary fermentation technique. So the difference between the two wines is that the Dariush wines were much bigger and much more bold than what we did. So in some ways, what were you doing was very different from what Dariush was doing, and I think that it was very much distinct in terms of what, in fact, was not vinification being part of the terroir. So I just wanted to throw that out there, and I'll take my
get a response from Kermit Lynch.
Well, when I started my business back in 1972, when I would visit a winery, the sons had learned from their fathers and the fathers from the grandfather, etc. But almost immediately appeared on the scene graduates of enology school. And on the other thing that's changed is the sons would go to a wine school. The trouble is there were only a couple in the country. One was Bordeaux and one was Dijon. In other words, Bordeaux and Burgundy. Bordeaux and Burgundy, the wines are raised in small barrels. And in a lot of the wines, you have new oak. So you imagine a kid from Bandol or Chateauneuf-du-Pape is sent by his parents to learn about wine, and what he learns is how to make Burgundy or Bordeaux. So he comes back, and he sees all these big oak casks that have been used, that sort of cask for centuries in the south. And he says, well, what's wrong? They don't know what they're doing. We've got to do these wines in barrel to make great wines. That's just one example, but that's what I saw happening. And a large part of my work was to try to convince the sons to look back and look how their forefathers did it and say, maybe they weren't stupid. Maybe they knew what they were doing. Maybe they learned from their experience. Why is it in the South, maybe it's better to use a big cask to raise your wine than a little woody barrel?
Well, you've done
like that.
You don't know... because I asked you before when I air my friend John DeLuca, but as head of the Wine Institute, he really went back to the roots and started saying, we have to go back. Instead of moving in the direction we're going, we have to look at the cultures they came out of. We have mm-hmm. to also look at their medicinal effect. And, 60 Minutes did that famous piece about the heart and the heart being helped through wine. And suddenly wine took on a whole great... because there was an attempt really to condemn it as alcohol. It was a kind of,
Well, it's still included.
Well, it's still, yeah. No, it's, but I mean,
Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
It is alcohol. Let's face it. I mean, it is alcohol, Kermit. No,
I don't even have
that.
A gun, and I have to deal with the BATF.
Do you find some people are sort of intimidated by this whole wine culture, though? And, you know, I mean, francophilia that's rampant in it and all that?
I think Americans are. I think American men are more intimidated than women. I don't think American women are intimidated by it. They seem to have their noses wide open. But men, it's like they're so afraid they're going to say the wrong thing or not know something. That's what I notice in the States. And in France, I notice another thing is they're 100% confident. Everybody's sure they're a wine connoisseur. And they're so far from being wine connoisseurs. Each country has its sort of character. The macho American, you know, the know-it-all Frenchman.
What do you think of our – can you make a general statement? Maybe this is impossible, but about sommeliers here in the United States side, do they know their wines generally?
Oh, more than ever. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the most exciting things happening today, a restaurant wine list. That I love. I mean, if I have a proud child, I think it's today's sommeliers.
I just want to read an email because we're talking about the snobbishness and that's sometimes associated with the wine industry. Linda writes, I'm a winemaker and I have many friends on the production side of the business as well as your side, Kermit's side of the business. I just have to say that you sound incredibly nice and humble. And there seems to be too many people in the wine biz with overinflated egos. I would just like to say thank you. So that's a nice little prop there. And let me get a caller on here. I think it's a restaurateur from up north. Eric, hi.
Hello. Thank you, Michael. I mean, firstly, I wanted to thank you for the show. I mean, I've been listening to your show for years, and it's always great. Mr. Lynch, yourself, I've been listening to you when you did City Art on Lecture with the owner of Bonnie Doon Winery. And being a restaurateur and selling wine, I'm also kind of a sommelier. We've got a 400-bottle wine list. I use your name and your website all the time. You are a source of wisdom, and I want to thank you.
Well, thank you. Let's try to guard my humility here.
Very nice of you, Eric, to call.
Nice.
And we'll go to – and by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. I'd like to hear from some listeners in terms of what wines you especially fancy or covet. And let's go to Hayward caller. Van, hi.
Hi. My question to the author is, you know, I'm aware of wine pairings with food, but I'm wondering if he's ever thought about wine pairings with social context. Like, are there wines well suited for playful conversation, wine suited for serious conversation, and wine serious for contemplation?
Van, I'm sorry. I'm thinking, and Kermit probably knows this. You remember that old Have some Madeira. You know, I'm sorry. A very seductive guy's voice. Have some Madeira.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about seductive situations, but I'm older.
Yeah. Kermit, if you would.
Well, I would give that a little thought. I think it's natural when you're choosing which wine to open. I think if you've got a wine cellar, you've got a variety of wines down there, and you're going to make a decision about what am I doing tonight and what sounds best under the conditions. It just seems to me an automatic
logic. Oh,
it's logical to do that.
Mark asks, has Mr. Lynch seen the film Bottle Scotch, and what does he think of the Judgment of Bottle Shock, excuse me, and what does he think of the Judgment of Paris and all the subsequent anniversary tastings? It seems pretty clear to me that for a certain kind of wine, California has consistently rated on top. Meanwhile, some of the best wines I have ever had have been little Italian producers, which I find once and then and never see again.
No, I haven't seen the movie. I'm of course I'm aware of that tasting, it's incredible influence. For example, to my taste, after that Paris tasting, the Bordeaux changed in reaction to that tasting, and started making wines much more in the California style. Much to my chagrin. I used to love the old Bordeaux, but when I say I love the old Bordeaux, they were vinified in those days with a lot of seeds and stems in them, and they had this tannin that could be kind of mean when the wine was youthful. They wouldn't win tastings. They were closed. It was a wine you'd taste 20 fathers bought the wines for their kids. They would put those cases of Bordeaux down. They wouldn't open them up and compare them to other wines. They just went in the cellar. The kid, 25, 30 years later, he would have this great old Bordeaux to sell. Well, we can't do that anymore with apartment living and everything. I'm aware of that. But some of those fabulously complex old Bordeaux wines, that's been lost in this effort to win tastings a year before the wine's released. The Bordeaux owners are showing their wines to wine critics and being judged on that 100-point scale. It's ludicrous.
Here's another caller. Ken, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, I had a question about your newsletter and some of the terminology you use. There are some of your wines I absolutely love, the Grave, some of the Pinots, but some of the more tannic wines, I will read a rave review in your newsletter, and I'll buy a couple bottles on that basis, and then I just really don't like them. I remember one term you once used, just one of your writers, was chewy, and I now know whenever you say chewy that it's probably going to be way too tannic for me and I should avoid it. But I kind of wish there was a little more guidance in the way the words are used to help me know which might be right for my palate and which might not be, like the Lascaux, some of the Southern France wines. Any comment about that?
Help me
interpret.
Sure. It's hard to write about the way wine tastes, just like it's hard to write about how music sounds. The vocabulary is so difficult, and I think today American wine tasting notes have turned absolutely loony, where the wine critic will tell you it smells like, and he'll name 10 or 12 fragrances that he finds in the aroma of one wine. And how to communicate to somebody with words how a wine's going to taste, I think the way it worked for you is the way it's got to work. It's you had the experience. You saw, now you know what chewy means. You don't like it. Tannic, now when we talk about a big tannin, you know you're not going to like that. I think you've just got to sort of psych out from the vocabulary used what the wine might. We're trying to express it as well as we can so that you'll know. But believe me, it's not easy.
Thank you for the call.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish, Ken, please.
Yeah, sometimes I read some of the other, some in your newsletter, but a lot of the time, other writers, and I can't understand how they come up with things like, I'm exaggerating, but moldy and tobacco flavor or whatever, a combination of words that doesn't sound very appealing, and yet they're they're raving about a particular wine. So
I'm with you, Ken. I think it's absurd, and I think it's off-putting, because I'll take that same wine. This is worth going into if we have a second here. I'll take that same wine that the critic has found to be, and name your 10 adjectives, raspberry jelly, da da da. You go through the lemon skin. I saw one that was inner lemon skin, and I smell that wine. I don't get all that. I don't know what they're talking about. But okay, I've been at this. I'm a professional. I have confidence in my palate. It's no problem. But for the general public, they're going to take that same wine and smell it and say, "I can't smell any of that. I must be a lousy taster. I'm not going to explore this world of wine because obviously my nose doesn't work." I think it's off-putting, all that, and it's not. I just have to say it outright. It's not true. Those wines don't smell like all those things.
Do you actually like Robert Parker, though, don't you?
I like him a lot, yeah.
I mean, he's the guy who gave us that 100-point system.
I wish Robert and I had a friendlier rivalry. Sometimes it's turned a little unfriendly, but when the periods when we've been friendly, it's really been great, yeah.
Here's Scott, who writes from his perspective, as someone who has experienced the true, deeply ecological meaning of old French concept of terroir, I'm curious what Kermit thinks about the violently disruptive practices of non-organic industrial vineyard production in California and elsewhere, such as reliance on toxic pesticides and soil sterilization, as well as the potential impact of climate change on the very survival of the great wine-producing regions of France and elsewhere.
That's a long – I could write a book about that.
I bet you could.
That's a big subject.
I think he wants to know maybe your take. Are you angry about it? Are you indignant about it? Or are you just kind of stoic about it? What?
My own – politically, I have my opinions. I'm not very active politically.
Living in Berkeley?
I'm living in Berkeley because I've gotten so excited about it so many times. And look how much have things changed. So I'm afraid I'm kind of a defeatist when it comes to, unlike my friend Alice, I'm going to go out and change the world. If I can fill your glass with a good wine, I feel good about that. With my records, if I can fill your ears with something that gives pleasure, with the books too, I see myself, when I look at myself, and what am I trying to do? Because you ask yourself that every once in a while. And I think, I'm trying to give people pleasure in one way or another.
But you're a public figure now. I mean, you've got a lot of clout.
I'm not that public.
People know who you are. They write you up in the New York Times. You get national exposure. You've had best-selling books. I mean, you could, if you wanted to, probably step forward, but maybe it's just not in your DNA.
Well, it's not in my DNA. I think I'm more Kermit the Hermit than a public figure.
What about that name Kermit? That's a Sesame Street name. Most people associate it with Kermit.
I was there before.
No, I know you were there before. I don't want to take any of that away from you. But
they took my name.
That's not your real name, is it?
Kermit is my name.
Is that your actual name? That's your real name.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's Robert who writes. You'll like this. I love shopping in Kermit's store and for the most part agree with his point of view. However, there's been an ongoing movement toward delicate winemaking in the United States, and if it lacks support, we'll never hit critical mass. We have not sent wine out for review since the 80s because we know that the most powerful wine wins a blind tasting. Quite simply, wine is not an athletic event. We need support from people like you who have an opinion of what wine can be.
Like me or you, Michael?
Like you.
Well, I think I've done everything I can to support that point
of view.
Nobody
wants to know
what
I think about wine. Let me get some more callers on here, and we'll go to Marin. Henry, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I find that many times when I go to a restaurant that almost all the wines, unless they have an extensive wine list, almost all the wines are fairly young. And I've read that in many cases, wines, when they're that young, they're not really meant to be drunk yet. And so I wonder what you think about that and what you recommend about that.
I think it's really sad. I agree that's the case, and it's really too bad. It's true all over the world. There's too many people, not enough great wine. When I first started going to France, I'll tell you, to make young people jealous, there were still on restaurant wine lists, it was very easy to find wines from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and they were not that expensive. It was just sort of taken for granted in France that a good restaurant would have old wines too. And it gave me the chance to taste those old wines. And I'm sure that had a lot to do with forming my palate, forming my attitude toward wine. But you go to France today, that's just not the case.
How's your French now? When you started out, you couldn't speak barely a word of French, wasn't that the case?
I think in the cellars, 100%. I think everybody understands me in the cellars. When the plumber comes over, things get a little hairy. But
as long as it's the cellars. Vanessa is our next caller. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, good morning.
And Vanessa's calling from Palo Alto. I should say we have a whole contingent visiting us from Palo Alto.
I was going to say, Kermit, you're in the studio with some of my favorite friends to drink wine with.
Well, bring a bottle in here. Let's keep this party going.
Exactly. Well, I first wanted to thank you for being my wine guru. And I started the journey 14 years ago to kind of build out my wine palette and my cellar. It was always a very easy thing to walk into a restaurant and say, well, what here is imported by Kermit Lynch?
Oh, wow.
And so it was kind of a fun way to know that I was going to get something good. And I really agree with your earlier statements where you said it's really all about having diversity. Mm-hmm. And there's a wine for everything, including the Ruli event you had in your parking lot with oysters to, you know, rosé every day, not just summer.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, when I go to my cellar, we typically reach for the Châteauneuf du Pape, Du Telegraph, and, you know, it always makes me wonder, are we ever going to see in California a movement toward having more of the blended types, you know, not the hugely tannic or alcohol or, you know, 85% Cabernet.
Yes,
we are. In a bottle.
Yes, we are. There's no question about it. We've already been there. I mentioned I opened in 72, so I was able to taste California wines from the 40s, 50s, and 60s back in those days. Some customers had old bottles in their cellar. I loved those wines. They were as good as any wines in the world.
They started going astray in the 70s.
I think they started going astray. Not everybody, maybe, but when the point system started meaning big bucks, we're capitalists, right? This is the United States. A lot of wineries started changing their wine in order to get big points and big bucks. That's the way I see it.
We'll go to some more listener emails. Terry writes, you were asking how one goes about finding out about wines. There's a fantastic phone app called Thumbs Up Wine Finder for just that purpose. You can find out detailed descriptions from the creators who have actually tasted the wine, as well as search your grocery store to find out your best purchase for the flavor you'd like. It's incredibly useful to the layperson. And Laura writes, does Mr. Lynch really think that you can taste soil in the wine? There are environmental science papers that say plants do not take up toxins in the soil, such as lead. So maybe the minerally descriptor is really describing something else.
That's possible, but I'll tell you, for example, I import a lot of Vermentinos. There's one plot of land on the island of Corsica that has a soil just like Chablis, in other words, decomposed oyster shells. And in that Vermentino grape, I'm finding the kind of depth and the kind of I don't think they taste like soil or earth. I mean, that doesn't sound very tasty to me. But people use the word today. It's fairly new in the wine world, minerality. I think sometimes I get that. Sometimes I think that people mistake, too, when there's a good natural acidity. They call that minerality for some reason. This isn't all clear.
This isn't all clear.
But certainly I'm convinced that the soil influences the taste of the wine. I've experienced it thousands and thousands of times.
Here's Bob, who says, I'm wondering what Mr. Lynch's views are on boxed wine. The French appear to have embraced the idea. In the south of France, you can go into a grocery store and find a huge pyramid of rosé like you'd find a huge pyramid of Coca-Cola here in the United States. A close friend of mine started importing small batches of boxed Rhone wines but had a hard sell here. It seems in Europe, wine is more is for drinking, where in America it's more about status.
And France, although this consumption's going down with the younger people over there, they're going more to cocktails and drinks like that. But bag in the box, I'm all for it. I've tried to import a couple of wines. Seemed like such bargains, you know, you keep it in your refrigerator, and the sort of wines my old friend Richard Olney called mouth rinse.
Oh, geez.
Well, I liked that phrase, yeah. You know, a little something cold out of the fridge before you go get a good bottle to sort of rinse your mouth out. And I found, my staff found, I didn't do it myself, but the part that handles the importation, there were a lot of conflicts to try to get the wine in and still sell it at a good, cheap price. And when the day comes when I can do that, I'll be right there with them.
Do you have any idea how the French manage to consume so much wine and eat so many pastries and breads and stay so thin?
Well, today I'm noticing a lot more and more fat Frenchmen and women.
Well, that gets rid of some of my old schadenfreude. Here's Adam who says, although I love Burgundies, I have frequently purchased Burgundies that, regardless of price, have bordered on the undrinkable. I note wild inconsistencies in French wines, whereas California wines from a given producer, region, varietal, vintage, etc., seem to be more consistent and predictable.
I wish I were knowledgeable enough about buying California wines to answer that. I really have no idea, but I want to point out one thing that a lot of you already know about me. Every wine I import is imported in a refrigerated container, and a lot of French wines aren't. I was just recently told by the transporter for most of the wines that come to the States that I'm still the only person who does 100% reefer, we call them, shipments to the United States. And wine is very subject to heat damage. And you can imagine a boat coming up, you know, going through the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, up the Mexican coast. That wine's going to get cooked.
Some of these fat Frenchmen you were talking about who aren't refrigerating their wines?
It's a way to save probably about 10 cents a bottle. Forget the reefer.
Now, Kermit Lynch, I want to remind listeners about some events that you're going to be appearing at, and there are a number of them coming up. All I have to do is find the sheet of paper here that has all of those on them. I'll have somebody bring it in. But in the meantime, are you writing? Are you doing another book? I mean, aside from your blogs and things like that. I mean, you got a book in mind. You could turn.
I've got a book in mind. You know, for the past few years, I've been making CDs, and been concentrated on that and not writing.
Doing stuff with Boz. Doing stuff with Boz Gags.
Well, Boz sort of got me back into music. But he and I haven't worked together since that first CD. I've been working with a fellow named Ricky Fattar, who lives in Berkeley. He was the drummer on my first CD. Anyway, now I'm getting these ideas for a book again.
Well, good luck to you, and enjoyed very much having you on. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
The book, again, is Adventures on the Wine Route, a Wine Buyer's Tour of France. We'll post on our website the appearances he's making, so just go to kqed.org if you want to find them out. I have to give credit for the people behind the scenes here. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. I do this, of course, with grace and pleasure. And Tina Larberg, our engineer is Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClyman, senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.